Welcome, everybody, to this edition of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. League Cup action on Sunday handed out the first piece of silverware in the English season. Liverpool, Manchester City, it took more than 120 minutes to find out. Earlier on Sunday, one of the biggest matches on the calendar saw Arsenal visit Manchester United. Unfortunately for Arsenal fans, it was pretty typical Arsenal stuff. Leicester, Spurs staying at the top of the league with one-goal wins. But let me bring in my co-hosts, Lawrence McKenna and Nipun Chopra, to talk about everything that happened. And let's start with the last match of the weekend. Lawrence at Wembley League Cup. 1-1 game, goes to penalty kicks, pretty much gave us the excitement that we would want in a cup final. Manchester City doing a much better job in the shootout, claims the first piece of silverware of the season. Tell me your general impressions of the match.
I think there's a lot you can definitely take away for Liverpool and probably Man City as well going forward. Overall, I thought it was a pretty good game, well contested, but in terms of the tackles and people sort of playing it in the way that you want a final to be played, I think. And actually, for some weird reason in London, this was a really big event. It was really hard to get tickets for it. Both sides seemed really hyped up.
Like more than previous seasons, it was difficult to get to this final?
Like most seasons, to be honest, there's usually tickets sort of floating around at a reasonable price. But if you wanted to get into this stadium, it was pretty unreasonable prices to get in. And it, you know, I think that's partly down to the sort of the way that Wembley have looked to build themselves up, and also the way the FA have looked to build this up. And I think also Capital One have looked to build this up too, just to make it an event again. And to some extent, I think they got that out on the pitch. It's really nuanced tactical decisions by both managers. And I'm really enjoying where Klopp's taking this team. You know, there's some interesting conclusions as to, you know, what Liverpool fans took away from it, as to whether they should keep Lucas, whether they need to sell the likes of Lallana and Milner, Moreno. And just in terms of turning this squad around, which direction he's taking it in, and therefore how it's shaped. And I really like it.
Moreno probably doesn't need to be sold. I mean, if you just bring in a coach that'll tell him to face the people he's trying to tackle, I think everything will be okay. I appreciate the behind-the-back tackle kind of bringing some Steph Curry flavor to the soccer field, but it obviously didn't work. He got away with something a little bit there. Nipun, I want to get your general thoughts on the game. Both you and I believe, picked 2-1 results midweek, but we just had different winners. You had Liverpool. I had Liverpool. You had Manchester City. In that way, we were both close enough to write that we can say we saw this game okay, even though we were both wrong.
Yeah, it was definitely, I agree with Lawrence, it was a good game to watch as a quote-unquote neutral. I was at our local bar here, and it was packed full of Liverpool supporters and a handful of City supporters, and the place erupted when Liverpool equalized. There were chandeliers falling down and stuff like that. It was a very good experience, very good game. As I was telling you guys before we started recording, I thought Liverpool were the better team overall for the entirety of the extra time, whereas I thought City in general on the overall play, given the chances Sterling missed and what should have been a Stonewall PK, were a better team for the 90 minutes.
Lawrence, I want to ask you about Simon Mignolet's performance, because it seems like even more than his usual performances, a mixed bag. The goal from Fernandinho, pretty sharp angle, got between his legs from a decent distance. I don't think anybody.
It didn't actually go between his legs. He dived
on his side, yeah.
Sort of parry it. So it was in the area his legs should have been, but it wasn't through his legs.
Yeah,
I think he's going to be disappointed with that.
Thanks for correcting me.
For the rest of the game, I mean, credit to him, he didn't let it affect him. For the rest of the match, he pulled off some pretty incredible saves. It was a bizarre incident with Sacco early on. I mean, Sacco was very clearly groggy out on the pitch. And no one sort of thought, right, let's take the time. Just because he can, again, like, I find it just so bizarre that football has no way of dealing with these kind of things. And almost, you know, basically the culture of the fact that the game needs to be moved on faster takes precedent over someone stumbling around. And it just, I find it so bizarre. He was literally the only reason he was outfooted to even give Aguero that chance was because he had just hit himself in the head. And it's just bizarre. Like, he basically, Liverpool should have been given the time to make a substitution. It's that simple.
Yeah. Nipun, as a neuroscientist, what do you think about this whenever you see somebody clearly who is not even capable of carrying on normal life activities at that point being asked to still participate in a professional athletic endeavor?
First of all, I give a huge credit to Liverpool, to Klopp, and to Liverpool's medical staff for making that substitution, because you could tell that he did not want to come off and he threw a hissy fit. But that decision should always be taken out of the hands of the player, and I applaud them for that. What I want to say, which ties into what Lawrence talked about, there should be, and FIFA Pro were trying to introduce this legislation where they said, look, if we understand that you want your player back on the field, but we need to be able to make these concussion decisions on the sideline. If you're giving us 30 seconds to make that decision, that is not long enough, and you're putting these players in danger. So how do you deal with that? What FIFA Pro recommended was, if a player is undergoing concussion analysis, in the sense, if you're trying to diagnose whether Sako has a concussion, for example, you are allowed to put a temporary substitute on for the duration of discussing whether that player is concussed. And I think that's a terrific, terrific way to make all parties happy. But as always, FIFA vetoed it.
I don't know, Nipun. I don't even believe in substitutions at all. I mean, three subs. You know, when I was growing up, we had negative one sub. And the second half, you had to sacrifice a player. That's how old school I am. So all these people who think that concussions are a big deal, I don't know. I've had at least
Just walk it off, baby.
Yeah, I've had at least three or four different concussions today, which is probably why I'm exploring this line of reasoning for this issue.
You'd open the fridge differently. I just find it very bizarre. I mean, you know, it's a very, it's not a very small part of the game, because actually,
no,
you know, playing
major.
Torre, well, it's a, you know, this is a very unconventional back line. And for some weird reason, I think, again, through the lens of a manager, if that was Brendan Rodgers, I really feel like we would have read things differently if he was fielding Lucas and Sako. I think the narrative would have been, oh, it's shaky. He doesn't have any other options. Why did he choose Lucas over Torre? But for some reason, we trust Klopp with it. And you know, I think it was a good decision. I think Lucas has played actually terrifically at centre back and has probably outplayed Sako and Torre in that time. His positioning has been good. His reading of the game has been fantastic, and you know, it's helped him to make more of a place for himself in the Liverpool team.
I mean, this is something we're seeing in other teams across the world. Javier Mascherano, great partner for Gerard Piqué. We see David Alaba for Bayern Munich playing in central defense. The idea that you can
Alaba's different.
Alaba is different,
but
physically, at least, as far as his physical stature, he's not that much different.
Absolutely. I agree, yeah.
And that's kind of what we're talking about here, because people have this conception of a central defender needs to be X, Y, and Z. And really, you just need two people, well, three, two, one person to do a job. And there's no reason why Lucas, when paired with somebody that complements his skills, couldn't do that job back there.
No, it's a very good point. It's still very interesting, though, to see the difference in the dynamic between Sako and Lucas and Lucas and Torre. And I think it is very clear that Sako is obviously, there are certain players in this Liverpool team that I think Klopp appreciates more. And Sako is a very sort of unconventional looking defender. And for that reason, I think there's a couple of old school Liverpool fans that don't particularly appreciate him. But I do think he almost confuses the opposition sometimes because the way he tackles is unusual. I really enjoy watching him, and I think he's a great asset to the team. It's sort of the structure ahead of that, which I think maybe Klopp is working with. You know, it's still a fantastic front line to have Firmino, Coutinho and Sturridge up there, and they're interchanging. I think City really shut that down well today with essentially a block of four and then two wing backs.
Yeah, and to bring somebody with the talent and energy of Adam Lallana off the bench, obviously he's been highly criticized when he was by Liverpool fans when he's in the starting lineup, but he's still a very talented and accomplished player to have in your game day squad. I want to switch.
Can I ask you this, though?
I think that's basically the point is that Liverpool have to assess, is it better to sell the player now and get the value for them and then move on to something that would look better in a Klopp shape, or is it better to keep that player because you want them to work? And I think there's a difference between the two. I think you know, that's the hard part for a manager. It takes the vision to have to basically cut ties with the player and say, look, we need to move you on because you don't fit into the plans. And I think for a lot of people, they've earmarked Lallana and Moreno. Is that?
Can I ask something? So when now that we're dissecting the game, and obviously in retrospect, I'm thinking of the decision to bring on Lallana as one that is something that we should scrutinize, maybe, because with Lallana coming on, it's pretty much more of the same. You already have those flair players on the pitch with Firmino, Sturridge, and Coutinho, of course. If you had brought on Benteke, I know he brought on Origi a little bit later, but if you'd brought on Benteke, maybe he would have given them a slightly different option.
I guess that's the problem is I don't know if Klopp actually sees Benteke as another option. I think he sees the way that he sometimes gets a bit confused and sometimes moves break down through him. I imagine what he wanted was for the moves just to be flow in the way that they continued to flow. Maybe he wasn't looking for another option. He actually believed the system that Liverpool were playing would lead to something.
Yeah, that's my reaction too, that if anything needed to change, it was Liverpool's performance when Manchester City had possession and had the ball and was going forward. Mm. But as far as other places, I can see the justification for doing a like-for-like there. But yeah, I think it's worth at least talking about and scrutinizing a little bit, right?
I'm fascinated by Emre Can. Emre Can, for me, you know, he has some real flashpoints in the game and does make some fantastic tackles. I think overall, though, how he tactically influences the play needs to evolve and needs to change. And some people are even questioning whether a Milner-Can-Henderson midfield shape works.
Maybe
Liverpool need, I know it sounds terrible, but maybe Liverpool need another captain.
I think Can works much better when you have somebody that is just going to sit like Lucas in there and you can start to take advantage of more of his skill set.
The worry is that because of the title that Henderson has been given, which is captain, he sort of he's a token place. I don't believe that's true, but the perception is sometimes that he's sort of the token midfielder in there because he's the captain and because he sort of represents or is the closest to what Steven Gerrard represented for the club.
Do we really think that Jurgen Klopp has allegiance to a captain he didn't name? I think Jurgen Klopp's a fair man.
I don't think he does, but at the same time, I don't know if he knows if he wants to disrupt that now.
Mm. Gentlemen, let's talk about Manchester City in a second, but first, I want to talk to everybody about our new sponsor, SeatGeek. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated and then try to sneak in huge fees when you check out. You need to try SeatGeek. They've made it easier than ever to buy and sell sports and concert tickets. Just to give you an example, with the recent news that Arsenal is going to be coming to the country this summer, and we've got the Copa Centenario games happening starting in June, I've checked out SeatGeek to already see what tickets are going to be available for games in Santa Clara, in Seattle, even in Chicago. Months ahead of time, I can look at the SeatGeek app, see what the market is for these tickets, and start to make my plans for the summer. Well, SeatGeek is the only place I ever go to now for tickets or to a game or a concert, be it a soccer game or here in Portland, even a basketball game when I need to go see the Trailblazers. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone, and I just used it the other day to go see the Blazers play the Brooklyn Nets. SeatGeek has taken all the work and all the hassle out of buying these tickets. It pulls all the information from all the available sites into one place so that you save time and you never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will let you know when the ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek comes with a grade based on its value so that you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat inside the arena. Best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and always upfront about the price. Unlike StubHub, SeatGeek shows you the full ticket price from the start to the finish and never surprises you with huge fees at checkout. Listeners to this podcast, we have a special deal for you. $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code. Enter the promo code WSTPOD. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Download the free SeatGeek app today and enter your promo code WSTPOD.
I've just bought Beyonce tickets. You know what's amazing? I've clicked the Beyonce tickets, right? And there's like this little thing up in the corner. It says awful deal, amazing deal.
Really?
It even rates. Yeah, I needed Beyonce tickets. Please don't play this to my girlfriend. I needed Beyonce tickets. And a few weeks ago, I went on a website and I could only find awful deals. I've literally just clicked on this site and it's shown me good deals in exactly the seats I was looking at for £100 less than I could buy them on the other site.
Wow.
This is genuinely... Can I have $20 off now, please?
You absolutely can, and enjoy your Beyonce tickets.
You sorted me out.
Gentlemen, let's talk about the Manchester City side of the equation. I don't think anybody's going to be shocked that Manchester City won this trophy. They're obviously a very talented team. But if you take the broader view, this has been a bit of a turnaround week for Manchester City. Some questions coming into the week before they went to Ukraine, had a very convincing performance against Dinamo in Kiev, and then turned around with that travel in the week and put forth a very good performance with pretty much the same squad, not resting very many players. Nipun, I think that Manchester City could use this as a bit of a confidence boost, provided that all these players don't drop dead at some point in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. The injury thing is always an issue with them, right? Especially Aguero's hamstrings are something that I think need to be considered when you are cognizant of the fact that Bonny is still struggling. Iheanacho has done well. I was surprised he wasn't involved today. Yeah. But yeah, a huge week for them. You and I talked midweek or maybe last week about how Pellegrini was very unfairly derided for his decision to rotate in that Chelsea game. And ever since, it's proved to be a masterstroke. They won midweek. They won today on penalties. And on they go.
Hmm. So Lawrence, do you think this should change how some people are viewing Pellegrini? This is, after all, another trophy that he's won with Manchester City.
How do some people view him?
I think some people maybe are looking at Manchester City falling away from this title race and starting to take a little bit more of a negative opinion about what he brings to the team.
I mean, I was going to say this about the overall final. As well contested as I think it was, the amount of money that both sides have spent and the investment and squads they put together, I still think should be performing better than that, and especially Man City. I mean, you know, you look at that team, they've got Aguero up front, they've got Sterling just behind. I'm always significantly underwhelmed by how much investment does to any of these teams.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think he's had more than enough time to be able to do that. And I think for that reason, I do think there should be questions asked over whether Pellegrini's done well enough. But at the same time, I think Man City are also somewhat, they shoot themselves in the foot because they cultivate their own strange mentality. I think they're very much in a sort of between two worlds mentality. You know, they see themselves as this massive club, but then that's contrasted by the past. They see themselves as a very progressive team. That's contrasted by the fact their owners come from an area which is building all its money on something which is heavily rooted in the past. And all these kind of unusual disjunctions. And I think Manuel Pellegrini and any manager that's there, possibly bar Pep Guardiola, have to compete with those sort of forces because they're considered to be part of that as opposed to above that. I think that's why people are expecting there to be a big difference. I think definitely that anti sort of environment that the idea of even of Pep Guardiola at City has provided people with a different kind of analysis of Pellegrini. And that's the overall, there still should be more progress there in that time.
What are your thoughts, Nipun? I always have a little bit of trouble whenever we get too focused on money, because looking at money isolated to one team or one squad ignores the fact that other teams are spending money too. And sometimes
teams have invested badly as well.
Right. Well, and when you're going up against a team that also has a lot of talent, that doesn't always produce the most aesthetically pleasing game. I guess I get a little bit concerned about reading too much into these things kind of in a vacuum.
I think the problem we run into often when we're doing this analysis is that we're looking at it from a very, at a level very close to the ground. Whereas when we rate other teams or historical teams that were excellent, we tend to do that in forgetting the moments where they struggled. Whereas all the teams that we've ever really looked at had moments where they struggled. So when we're analyzing the City team and analyzing what arguably is overspending and analyzing what might not be the almost a Barcelona-esque football that we hope they might play, I think the problem is that we're trying to analyze them mid-season. And if I were to ask Lawrence the same question maybe 2 or 3 years from now, he'd probably remember the moments that City produced at the start of the season and might skip over some of the moments that City have struggled in mid-season.
I'm not saying they're a terrible side. I think within context, he as a manager is probably achieving things, but I think in the overall project, I think it's poor.
What would you like to see, Lawrence? What would you like to see? Would you like to see them win more games? Would you like to see them bring through more youth? What do you think they're failing at, I guess?
Well, I mean, arguably they are bringing through youth now. They got absolutely thrashed by Chelsea. But, I mean, you know, they've still got Iheanacho coming through. But then a lot of people come to the conclusion that Iheanacho would have come through in any side. because you know,
and I mean, he's not truly their youth product anyway. But so what is it about City that bothers you, I guess?
Well, what bothers me about City is, I mean, I think you could put this to any owner, but you know, the ownership and the way that they, there are no questions significantly about any royal ownership of any club. Mm. The fact that they've spent a lot of money in the time they've been there, and that has definitely disrupted things in some way. I'm appreciative of the academy and all those kind of things and all the reach out, but you almost get down to the old Chris Rock side, which is you're supposed to. Mm. Like, that's often what I come down to with football teams, is like, well, they're doing this and they're doing that. And I know it's all within context, but you do sort of come back to, you're supposed to do that. Like, that's how it's supposed to work. And I guess it just leads me to be significantly underwhelmed by a lot of what these huge institutions are doing, both on and off the field.
But just because City has the talent to win leagues and cups doesn't mean we shouldn't still celebrate them when they do win leagues and cups.
But I guess what I'm saying is, for me, it's not so much about measuring whether they win or lose. You know, I in many ways, you know, some of the most interesting parts of football are watching your team lose. And, you know, that as an experience, I think a lot of people are sort of focused on the fact that this squad or this team has to win. And I'm not even saying that I know that obviously it's a positive thing for them to see City win. But, you know, is that by any cost? Is that by any system? Because I think a lot of people are experiencing that, you know, if they have Mourinho in, like at Chelsea, or questioning whether if they bring Conte in. But that's why it seems to be, that's why Pellegrini is one of those unusual fits, because it's sort of like, right, he is actually going to bring some entertaining football. He is going to bring something that is going to at least bring the PR and the perception of Man City to be something positive. Because Barcelona did the same. But we also forget how for a very long time in Spain, and you know, in a number of other places, and I think online as well, Kartik experienced the same. He had to speak to so many people about Barcelona fans and people who watch Barcelona saying, you're not playing good football just because you're not playing our brand.
Do you guys think that maybe with City, something that's going on is that they're a little bit underwhelming or unremarkable in their personnel? They don't have a Mourinho or LVG falling on the sidelines. Like today's Pellegrini's comment after the game when he was asked about why he picked Caballero, and he said, my word is more important than football. Now, as a purist, I love that, but I can see that sort of thing not annoying, but feeding the narrative that he's kind of boring and doesn't have much of a personality. And I wonder why. I wonder if that's what feeds into a somewhat blasé narrative about City.
Not so much for me. I don't really experience. Like, I like him. I like all the stories I hear about him.
I do too.
I mean, you know, a lot of South American players or players that have been under him speak about his great relationship with them and how he was not brutally honest, but sort of very barefaced with a lot of people, and made it very clear why he was selecting people. I think Diego Forlan is quoted in quite a few different places as sort of saying about his experience with him. And so I don't think it's so much that. I do also think it's partly the way the players, you know, I don't feel particularly inspired by Raheem Sterling. He's a good player, but I don't feel particularly inspired. Same for David Silva, same for Aguero even, the same for Yaya Toure, the same for Fernandinho and Fernando.
This sounds crazy to me.
You're
mentioning some of the best talents in England, and you're saying you're not inspired by them, which that, of course, is your prerogative. But the first thing that I think of is, if you're not inspired by those talents, I completely get why you find Manchester City boring, because it sounds like maybe you find a lot of things boring.
Shots fired.
but that'd be my point, is that it's why maybe, you know, I mean, obviously there's a lot of intangibles in football that we end up discussing in the end, but there is this sort of, I guess it's this kind of faceless corporatism that's brought these guys together, which is why I find a little less exciting.
The mercenary thing, but I feel like
I like them as people and characters, but I can appreciate that. But at the same time, there's something that is taken away from the overall side of that. So as individuals, and I can appreciate them.
So at some point, somebody or some team's identity becomes so entangled with the money that supports them that you personally can't dissociate the two. Like, now these players are not only good players, but they're players that are part of this club that is spending so much money, and they're reaping so many benefits off of it. And you're unwilling to disentangle those two things.
It's not that I'm unwilling. I mean, you know, I appreciate what Aguero has done in terms of those things. But then if you put it in that context, I can appreciate what Aguero's done. But in another context, I find it it's difficult to take away from the fact that they do need to be competing every season, and they should be competing on all fronts.
Do you feel the same way about Liverpool?
Yeah, I mean, there's something that I find very difficult to discuss about Liverpool. I think the corporate structure at Liverpool for years has been a real problem. And I think if you, it's making it difficult. One of the few reasons I'm sticking with Liverpool right now is because of, the ties that I've had since I was young. But the problem would be that those are being eroded by the fact that in more recent years, we've come over discussions where Liverpool froze the people out who lived around Anfield. They refused to pay good prices for their houses. This was before the Americans came in, either set of them. Mm-hmm. And they froze those people out of their homes.
Don't tell David Kahn that.
And they took away... David Kahn knows about it and has written about it. And you can go to Liverpool and get a tour of these places. But it seems like people want to ignore that side of things because it doesn't fit in with their narrative. Mm. I can appreciate one thing and disentangle it from the other. I can appreciate what Rafa Benitez achieved at Liverpool in that time. But at the same time, I find it difficult to really care about a team when I find out the overall institution is taking away from other, when you see the wider picture, essentially.
No, and you're certainly not the only person.
It makes it difficult to support the Mavs. Yeah, no one likes the Mavs. Why? Cuban.
I don't know about that. The Mavs are more popular than ever right now. A lot of people feel the same way about Bayern Munich. There's a reason why a lot of people in Germany view that as a corporate institution, and a lot of people in various leagues around the world are not going to get behind these clubs that are spending so much money because it, on some level, disagrees with their vision of what they would want their club or football in general to be. Gentlemen, we've talked about this game for long enough. Let's go ahead and take our first break right now. When we come back, we'll focus on the other Premier League match of the weekend, the other Premier match of the weekend in the Premier League, Manchester United upsetting Arsenal at Old Trafford. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk podcast. So just to clarify, this is a Premier League match that is also Premiere. I stumbled upon that in the last segment. But now that we've gotten those semantics out of the way, let's actually talk about the result. The surprise result of the weekend, maybe not that Manchester United won this game 3-2 over Arsenal, but based on who Manchester United play, Nipun, and the hype around Arsenal throughout the year, this being their year to win the title. If anything says typical Arsenal, same Arsenal as ever, it is losing 3-2 at Old Trafford to a team that played so many of their youth players.
Yeah, I have to say that that's correct. Before the game started, I was when I saw United starting lineup, seeing Carrick and Blint as central defense. We had De Gea back; it was basically unchanged. And then De Gea playing in goalkeeper instead of Romero, and then Rojo coming in instead of Riley. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself that there's no way that Arsenal does not beat this Manchester United team. In fact, I kept thinking to myself that this game has a lot of echoing moments of when United beat Arsenal 8-2. At that time, Arsenal had gone through their own issues with huge injuries. They had Jenkinson playing, Gnabry playing, and they had a bunch of players who had been injured, and United just smashed them that day. And that's seriously how I thought this game would play out. And I guess my whole argument that Arsenal is a changed unit this season is falling apart, and I think Karthik's is too, because this is a game that Arsenal really should have won.
Lawrence, I want to get your thoughts on it, but first, regarding that youth comment, Manchester United had 9 academy products in their team today. 6 of them actually saw action, and of course the one that people are going to remember most is Marcus Rashford scoring 2 goals and assisting on what was eventually the game winner in the 65th minute for Ander Herrera. Manchester United was up 3-1 at that time. Mesut Ozil quickly pulled Arsenal within 1. United held on for the win. Lawrence, what Nipun said, the idea that so many of us, and I think us is fair because we've all entertained this argument at various points this year, thought that Arsenal was a changed team. And maybe they are. Maybe this is just a one game and we shouldn't read too much into it. But since the turn of the calendar, Arsenal has not really looked like a title winning side. And for those people that were still holding on to that notion, Sunday's result might be a huge wake up call.
Arsenal's team don't apparently historically score a lot of goals at Old Trafford. I think the last time they did score 2 was actually in that 8-2 thrashing. That's just as much of a together side. But part of that, I think, is the analysis of what Wenger's actually trying to do there. Because post-game, he said, one thing we didn't know too much about was Rashford's movement. which is pretty incredible, really, because, you know, he's pretty, obviously, Wenger very famous for not doing too much research on the opposition. But at the same time, you'd sort of think, well, if you're that confident then in your system, then your system should be able to deal with that kind of movement. Mm-hmm. It seems very clear that they couldn't deal with his movement inside the box. United knew that, and it wasn't as if Rashford scored like incredible goals.
Right.
You know, I sort of feel like, you know, whilst they were good, I still feel like it's his movement that Arsenal really struggled with, and their system didn't manage to hold up against that. And that's what I find so incredible.
Hmm. Marcus Rashford, 18-year-old academy product. Nobody outside of probably hardcore Manchester United fans had heard much about him. Nipun, can you tell me anything about this guy? And if you can't tell me anything, sure, at least tell me what you saw on Sunday, because you come out, make your debut, score two goals and assist on another against one of your team's rivals. That's about as good a debut as any professional could hope for.
Absolutely. So Rashford has been at the club since he was 8 years old. So 10 years ago, essentially, he started training with United, signed his professional contract in 2014. City actually almost signed him and then passed on him, saying that he was too small. He
too
scored a
They then signed Raheem Sterling a few years ago.
Yeah, legend Raheem Sterling. He also scored in the UEFA Youth League earlier this year, games against Wolfsburg and PSV. Now, I have to point out that this was his Premier League's debut, but he did score two goals against Michelin midweek. So he's essentially now scored four goals in two games and has an assist.
Wow.
In 4 days.
And not only that, but he scored with his first shot in the Premier League.
Yep, that's also accurate. Wow. So he's now the youngest player in Manchester United history to have scored in European competition, beating, guess who, George Best. So that's pretty elegant company to be in. So for me, it was, you know, just incredible to watch this kid play. I think what Lawrence said has a lot of importance to notice, that these weren't the kinds of goals that we saw. So let's go back a few years. Against Aston Villa, Federico Makeda scored what was an incredible goal on the turn. Welbeck's first goal against Sunderland, a 5-0 mauling. Incredible goal from 40 yards out. All four goals for Rashford were inside the box and were goals that you want to see the kinds of runs strikers make. And that was encouraging to see because, you know, we as a United supporter, I was pretty freaked out by the fact that Martial pulled off injured in the Michelin game. Before the Michelin
almost
game.
Almost Hernandez.
He's the Mancini and Chicharito.
And I mean, there are shades from the distance that he scored his first goal of a sort of Ruud van Nistelrooy-esque kind of distance. I don't want to put him in that same box. I don't think he's anything near that kind of player. But I do think sometimes in recent years, United have really lacked that side to a player when they've not had a Hernandez on. And what's great is also that he was so prominent in both those games. So it's not as if he sort of just popped up and was suddenly, you know, there's a moment and he's done it. He was very prominent in the side. And I like that. I think there's something so likable about him. You know, the youthful exuberance and everything else is fantastic.
Let's talk about the managers here, gentlemen. Louis van Gaal, under more scrutiny these last couple of weeks, the Mourinho reports kicking up. Lawrence, this is a huge result. This is a result that nobody really saw coming. It gets them within 3 points of the top four. Maybe rekindles some hopes Manchester United can return to Champions League next year. Of course, it's against a big rival. Does this more than buy time for Louis van Gaal? Does this give us reason to really reconsider what he's doing, particularly given how many young players were in this team today?
You could take that way, or you could also say maybe he's bringing all these young players in because he knows that he doesn't have much time left and wants to leave somewhat of a legacy. I mean, you know, either way, you can write a narrative. For me, I think for not only for me, but for a lot of people surrounding the club, Mourinho feels somewhat inevitable. You could take that as negatively or as positively as you want. And I think for that reason, it's probably a good time for United to be doing this. You know, whether they're in the Champions League or not, if you've got Mourinho there, you've got a pull towards the team. And I imagine, you know, not only Mourinho, but just with Van Gaal leaving and this sense of a new dawn, it's going to bring in a certain kind of player and bring a certain kind of air. I guess what's worrying, if it does feel like Mourinho is inevitable, is all this youth that is coming through to Van Gaal.
All going to be loaned out next year.
Yeah, but either that or, you know, they're going to really need to embed themselves within this team before Mourinho arrives. Either that, or actually, maybe United I think United maybe, and Van Gaal might be hoping, if he knows the Mourinho's coming in, maybe hoping that actually some of these players are going to prove themselves to have those qualities that Mourinho might look for in permanent team members.
And Nipun, I want to ask you about still. Nipun, I want to ask you about Wenger. I know you're one of your areas of expertise is Manchester United, but I want to ask you about Arsene Wenger. At some point, it seems like managers have to be able to meet bottom lines. And the undercurrent with that was apparent in the Van Gaal conversation, talking about the need to finish top four. That's kind of a bottom line for him. Arsene Wenger at some point needs to be judged against bottom lines, doesn't he? It seems like for the last 8 or 10 years, he's had these somewhat ethereal marks because Arsenal didn't have the money to buy and compete with other people. Well, now that's over. They're actually able to spend big. Now they should be able to compete for titles. Well, now the league doesn't have the same Chelsea and United's forces at the top of the league, and Arsenal, again, appears to be falling back. This is just a game where, bottom line, you have to find a way to win it if you are going to compete for a title. We've talked about Manchester United facing the other title contenders from here, between here and May, so this could be points dropped within that 14 league at this point. At some point, don't we have to be harsher about Arsene Wenger?
Absolutely, we should. And I think Wenger is the best manager in the Premier League. But he deserves a lot of criticism for this loss today, especially given the fact that, as we've talked about before, this is Arsenal's best chance since the Invincibles era to win the Premier League. The teams around them have fallen apart. Chelsea's fallen apart. Leicester and Spurs are ahead of them. City isn't playing as well as they should be. They are on the back of a couple of cup wins themselves, so it's not like they don't have any winningest players on their team. So what do you mean?
Winningest?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, what I meant to say, players that haven't won anything in the league. That was one of the things that annoyed a lot of Arsenal supporters was that Arsenal was signing players that hadn't won much before. So now they have players that have won from all over the world, from Barcelona and Real Madrid, and they themselves have won FA Cups. So they're, in that sense, I think Arsenal should have won this game. And what I think will happen probably is that they will end up losing the league by a couple of points, or maybe one or two, maybe 3 points. And they will look back to this game against this, what was a tattered, dilapidated Manchester United team, completely falling apart at the edges. And the fact that they dropped points in this game, all 3 points, is probably what lost them the league this season.
Perhaps the only silver lining for Arsenal is now that they're back in the pole position for the Arsene Wenger trophy, looking more and more likely to be fourth of four in that 14 league. The other scores from this weekend, let's run through them very quickly. We're going to talk about these games in the next two segments. The weekend in the Premier League started on Saturday. West Ham 1-0 victory at home against Sam Allardyce and Sunderland. Sunderland stays in the bottom three. Leicester got a very late goal from Leonardo Ulloa to get a 1-0 victory at home over Norwich. They stay top of the league. Chelsea, with two late goals against that stubborn Southampton defense, gets a very good victory at St. Mary's. Stoke, 2-1 victory at home at the Britannia against Aston Villa. Watford and Bournemouth play out a 0-0, while one of the more exciting matches of the weekend was the match that Nipun and I said was going to be the worst of the weekend. West Bromwich Albion scores 3 goals against Crystal Palace. Sunday's games, we've already talked to you about Manchester United 3-2 victory over Arsenal. Spurs, the overshadowed game of the weekend, 2-1 victory over Swansea to stay within 2 points of Leicester. Right behind Spurs at the top of the table, Arsenal 51 points, and then Manchester City on 47, though they now have a match in hand. At the bottom of the table, Norwich sits in 17th place with 24 points, the same number of points as Newcastle, who were off this weekend. Newcastle sits 18th, followed by Sunderland and Aston Villa. Gonna go ahead and take our second break right now. When we come back, we're gonna get players of the week, talk about the rest of the matches in the Premier League. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk Podcast. Welcome back, everybody. World Soccer Talk Podcast, our third segment of the show, where we are going to start to get to the other games in the Premier League 8-match schedule. We've only talked about one of those so far. Before we get to those other 7 matches, we're going to do our players of the week. I am going to go first, and you know, this is controversial, but I'm going to go ahead and take that Rashford kid from Manchester United. Marcus Rashford, I don't even remember Marky his name. Mark. But 2 goals, 1 assist on his Premier League debut. I only wish I would have actually paid attention to Europa League this week so I would have seen his actual debut, but as you guys know, I don't pay attention to Europa League. But he does get my player of the week honors. Nipun, let's go to you next.
It would have been Rashford, but since you've taken him, I'm going to go with Berahino. Berahino coming back into the West Brom. Okay, I'll have another one then if you want.
But, no, it's fine. You can have that one.
Okay. Don't listen to him.
Berahino was very good in this West Brom game. Out of the wilderness, back into form. And the best moment of the entire week, even though it wasn't a goal, was him cutting onto his right foot and shooting a curve shot that went almost top 90, but actually hit the post. It was just beautiful. Just if you haven't watched it, just watch him do that, and you'll wonder why Pulis didn't bite his own tongue and let him play earlier this season.
Yeah, Pulis doesn't really seem like a guy that's going to let that go easily, but thankfully he finally has, now that we're well past the winter window. Lawrence, your turn.
I'm going to go very easily with Marko Arnautovic. I think the more that he plays for this Stoke team, the more people seem to enjoy watching him play. I call him a rip-off Zlatan Ibrahimovic not long ago, and he does sort of boss people around in that way. Just get a different hairstyle. He does sort of boss people around in that way.
I don't think he even minds that comparison. I think he would like to be the kind of the dollar store Ibra.
Probably so.
the dollar store Ibra.
I mean, there's a hashtag at least, but I still feel like he's got a long way to go in this Stoke side. What I'm going to be interested in is what Stoke do in the summer to add to this team, which I imagine will be in terms of defense, upgrade the likes of Cameron, maybe Bardsley. Mm-hmm. And then I'll be even more interested to see whether they manage to keep hold of some of these players. Also, someone who definitely deserves a mention just because of his record was Fraser Forster. Obviously, he let in a goal that he'll be very disappointed with over the weekend. But before that, he set a new club record for minutes on the pitch without conceding a goal, which was into the hundreds above what they'd done before. So very impressive.
Very impressive. Unfortunately, Southampton's run kind of stopped. And as you guys probably know, I've been very high on the Saints' potential to actually challenge for the top four. I had to reset that a little bit. I'll take a rethink once I have some time to watch that game. But losing at home to Chelsea, the way that they lost to, something to reconsider. The rest of the matches of the weekend, Nipun, let's go ahead and start with you. What other match drew your attention?
The big one definitely was the West Brom Crystal Palace game. As I mentioned, Berahino started, and this was interesting to me.
I like how you describe it as the big one. West Brom hosting Crystal Palace is the big one.
Yeah.
It's only a small one if you're narrow-minded.
Yeah, well, we were extremely narrow-minded in the preview. We both thought that this would be a snooze fest. And we were both laughing at the fact that this had been picked by NBC, and man, did NBC get this right. So maybe it's the NBC effect. Interesting to me was that they played with a 4-3-3. We've largely derided the 4-5-1 they've played.
You're talking about West Brom?
West Brom. And they played with Berahino and Sessegnon supporting Rondon as the sole striker. Palace really struggled with that. They were carved open more very, very often. I thought that the Berahino, the third goal, I don't know if you guys got a chance to watch it, but was just incredible direct counter-attacking football. Olsen to Rondon, straight one-touch pass to Sessegnon, and then Sessegnon with an incredible pass to Berahino, left foot volley into the goal. Just exceptional goal. Berahino hit the post. Wickham's goal was very good also for Crystal Palace. So this was a very entertaining game. West Brom deservedly won, though.
Wickham's strike to sort of put it into the far corner is really incredible. Yeah. It wasn't direct to him, but I think it crossed in and sort of knocked on, and he strikes it across goal. It's a lovely clean strike from him. I think he score two in this.
He scored the first as well.
I took his goal total on the season from 1-3, so prolific.
He tripled his goal tally.
Prolific all
still
of a sudden.
Worrying for Crystal Palace again.
Look into your crystal ball. Tell me what the future of Alan Pardew is, Lawrence.
Probably crystals.
Crystals.
Probably crystal meth.
I mean the club, not crystal meth or anything like that,
Well, Crystal Palace is just in a free fall. They're in 14th place at this point. They have 32 points, which on one hand is 8 points above the drop. On the other hand, it's only 32 points, so you can't be really comfortable with that. I think the most concerning point about that, Lawrence, is the fact that there are now only 3 teams between them and the drop. They've been the worst team in the Premier League for a couple of months now, And it's not going to take that much for Bournemouth and Swansea and maybe one of Norwich or Newcastle to pass them. Should they be really realistically worried about relegation?
Well, the worrying side for them is they still have to play Sunderland in the next game. Then they play Liverpool. I don't know whether that's going to be such a big challenge, but then they play in the Premier League at least. Leicester, West Ham, Norwich, Arsenal, and then Everton. Obviously, there's not such a big worry, but there's quite a few teams in there that are basically looking for points for a reason.
You could just make up club names at this point, and I would say that they would be favorites to beat Crystal Palace. We have no proof.
It's not even favorites to beat them. Just, I mean, not only motivation, but also just, you know, the it's basically that I think they were looking to build on what they did, and they haven't built on what they did. You know, they've had some good performances, but fine, you're not finishing any higher this season. Again, it comes down to the Alan Pardew effect and the long-term effects of Alan Pardew.
Gentlemen, let's talk about another team that is challenging that worse than the Premier League label. They're tied with Crystal Palace in the form table at the bottom of the league with only 1 point through six matches, and that's Norwich. But whereas Crystal Palace had a very disappointing result and performance this weekend, Norwich almost got a point at league-leading Leicester. Your thoughts, Nipun? Is this a positive for Norwich, or are they at the bottom line state where they either get results or nothing?
Cameron Jerome should have scored from that header. I don't understand how he missed that. It just defies physics. The angle of the ball, I still don't understand how it went in, how it didn't go in. So I think he'll be very disappointed by that. Tetti was good on defense, so that was a positive. Norwich were actually better for a lot of the game, is I think what you were hinting at. But it came down to one piece of quality, and that quality came from was an incredible pass from Albrighton. Albrighton from on set pieces had been magnificent all evening, and it was rather appropriate that Ochoa's goal came from a ridiculously awesome cross across the 6-yard box.
Another kind of top versus bottom matchup this weekend saw Tottenham hosting Swansea. Swansea 16th place. I think a lot of us, well, at least me, I'm just going to call me us for the sake of this. It sounds better that way. A lot of us think Swansea has been playing better, but they're only 3 points above the drop. They now haven't won in four. Contrast that with Tottenham. They're top of the form table in the Premier League. 18 points from their last six games and a 2-1 win, Lawrence, over Swansea. I think at this point, perhaps remarkably, we've moved on from even questioning whether Spurs are a true title contender. I think now the questions are more about what is Spurs' ceiling?
Well, I think Spurs' ceiling was being disrupted at times by essentially a front three, probably four if you include Key sort of joining in there, in a very unusual formation against them. Basically, it was somewhat of like a 4-3-3, but it played out more like a 4-3-1-2. And I think Spurs struggled to cope with that at times. And then basically they managed to reorganize because Pochettino got them back in at halftime and basically said, right, this is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. But I still think that, you know, when it came down to judging whether Spurs are still in the title race, and the reasoning being, you know, they managed to come back from 1-0 down, I don't even know if that's how I want to measure them anymore. It's more about the way that the team's playing and how well they're playing together. They put together some very good moves in the sort of 70 to 80 minute mark when they scored their goals. And, you know, I think that's way more important, is they're working out how to play in the Premier League. And I think that that's really important for this team, especially considering it was Danny Rose and Nasser Chadli, and how important, you know, whilst we've been speaking about the central column for Spurs being good, which is Dele Alli just in front of the two central midfielders of very often Eric Dyer, and Dembele. Who else do they play when they're not? Dembele, sorry. And then that sort of alongside Eriksen. Today we saw a lot of width from them, and ultimately I think that's how they managed to outplay Swansea. So it's also the adaptability from them, and that was quite impressive.
Yeah, adaptability seems such a great word. Between the goal scorers today, the timing of it, the quick turnaround from Champions League, we really saw the depth of not only personnel, but options of tactics really tested. And although 2-1 at home against one of the four or five worst teams in the league probably isn't superficially impressive, maybe given the circumstances and maybe what we're still waiting to be proven for Tottenham, that they have the staying power, that they have the versatility, that they have the diversity to come up with these different types of victories. Maybe that is what's most important, like you're saying. They have the league's
obviously, best. Obviously, Richard,
Go ahead.
I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but they're also coming off the back of a 3-0 thrashing of Fiorentina.
Right.
Granted, in a league you don't watch, but still, you know, 3-0 thrashing of Fiorentina is very impressive.
Yeah. They now, by 5 goals, have the best defense in the league. They're tied for the best attack in the league. There are just very few indicators that Spurs aren't going to stick around. If anything, they might be slight title favorites. They're only 2 points behind Leicester. Gentlemen, let's talk about one more game before we take our break and then come back to the rest of the games. Let's talk about Stoke versus Aston Villa. We talked about a little bit when Lawrence named Marko Arnautović his player of the week. Nipun, I want to get your thoughts on this one because we talked about how Stoke kind of had to come out of their shell a bit in order to play a team that was going to give up the ball and has inferior talent to them. It seems like, although it took them a while, they were eventually able to do that.
Yeah, the Westwood moment was a clear PK. Just a stupid tackle on Bardsley. Arnautović scored a good PK. And Shaqiri, now here's a player that we've talked about this before, that Arnautović is probably their most effective player. But I think Stoke play best when Shaqiri gets on the ball and when he has time on the ball. And for a majority of the game, Villa actually did a good job of keeping Shaqiri quiet. A couple of times he got away from the holding midfielders, and one of those times he sent an incredible cross, a very good cross to Arnautović for what was a scrappy finish for the second. But I think that was the difference, again, was the fact that Shaqiri got on the ball on that one occasion.
Stoke also tweeted something funny during the game, didn't they? I can't remember what the line was, but it was something about basically it was banter, Richard, about Jolyon Lescott. And then the preceding tweet, succeeding tweet was, and the one after was the tweet which basically said, sorry, that was tweeted from our pocket. very, very funny. Although whether you should be making fun of, basically making fun of people who suffer because a millionaire is happy, I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah, the only banter you need with Lescott is his hair. So,
Let's go ahead and take our last break of the show. When we come back, we'll update you on Spain, Germany, the championship. We'll get to our top fours. We'll talk about the couple of games we haven't mentioned yet on the show, and then we will preview the full week of action midweek in the Premier League. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk Podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Let's take our quick tour of Europe, and let's start in Spain, where maybe Europe's match of the weekend was taking place. Sorry, Italian football fans, but most eyes nowadays are going to be focused on Madrid, where Real Madrid hosted Atletico on Saturday. The big significance of this one, besides two of the top six or seven teams in the world playing each other, it was Zinedine Zidane's first big test as manager at the Santiago Bernabeu, and unfortunately, he failed it shortly after halftime. Antoine Griezmann scored the only goal of the match, giving Atletico what is both a trademark and perhaps predictable 1-0 victory. That posed the possibility that Atletico could close the gap on Barcelona, but in the last match of the Spanish weekend, Barcelona hosting Sevilla, falling behind to Sevilla 1-0 early, ended up with a 2-1 victory. They stay 8 points clear at the top of the Spanish table. Real Madrid is now 12 points back of Barcelona and only 2 points up on fourth place Villarreal. Let's go over to the Bundesliga, where Bayern Munich, coming off of their big midweek win in Champions League, they did not win in Champions League, their almost win in Champions League, which should have been a win. They actually held their 2-0 lead this time at Wolfsburg, getting the victory there. They stay 8 points up in the table over Borussia Dortmund. Dortmund got a 3-1 victory on Sunday over Hoffenheim. They are 15 points up on Hertha Berlin, who got a victory on Friday against Cologne. Down in the championship, there's been a change at the top of the table, where Burnley, thanks to a 2-1 win at Bolton, is able to leapfrog Hull. Hull stumbling on Friday, a 0-0 draw against Sheffield Wednesday. Good result there for Wednesday, even though in sixth place they have Cardiff City nipping on their heels. Walking down the table in the championship, second place is now Hull. They're tied on points with Middlesbrough. Middlesbrough has two games in hand, though, and they're coming off a 2-0 win at Craven Cottage over Fulham. Fourth place, Brighton got a victory this weekend. Can't say the same for fifth place Derby, their first loss since letting Paul Clement go. They fell at Wolverhampton Wanderers. Gentlemen, let's get to our top fours. Nipun, you don't get to do top fours very often. Why don't you go first?
Okay. Yay. On form, I'm going to go Spurs, Chelsea, Leicester, Southampton.
Oh, and, damn it. That's my exact list.
Okay, well let me change
it. No, you don't, have, you, don't have change, you don't have to change
mine's
it.
Mine's Chelsea, Spurs, Leicester, and Southampton. No, actually, mine's Southampton, Leicester, Chelsea, and Spurs.
Now you're just lying to us. Which go, I think go to your end of your
for
list.
For all of us, come the end of the season, we can say, I mean, that's a definite top four, right?
Yeah, we're all going to agree on the top four at the end of the season.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the last podcast for two.
I don't know. Maybe I'll try to find a reason not to.
And then for end of the season, finally doing it, Spurs to win. Ooh. Leicester what? Second, Arsenal third, City fourth.
Whoa.
What is that to you to indicate that Leicester is going to drop away and drop any points?
Say that again?
What is that to you to indicate that Leicester is going to drop away and drop any points?
I think it's just, it's more a historical thing rather than, I know it's funny because I'm picking Spurs, right? But
funny, yeah.
It's just one of those things. I don't see them pulling away enough, and I do see them dropping points, even though they had a last minute winner in this game, which is very champion-esque, but not this game, this week, but yeah.
Lawrence, your end of your top four.
I'm gonna match Nipun up, but basically just swap Leicester and Spurs just for kicks.
Yeah, I'm gonna
look at Leicester playing this weekend. It was not inspirational, but you know, again, just continually sticking to what it is they need to do, and in the end breaking through. You know, doesn't matter what minute you score, as long as you continue to just do what you are supposed to do. And they, you know, very often they just stick to the game plan and it just keeps working.
I also don't know if having 2 weeks off after what happened at Arsenal was necessarily a great thing for them. I think like a boxer that just dealt with their first defeat, it might have been best for them to get right back into the ring. And maybe that explains a little bit why they struggled with Norwich. But either way, like you said, it ended up being a little bit inspirational that they were able to still get 3 points out of it.
Were they always going to have that? Was he going to give them the time off because of that or not? Was he might have just given them the time off anyway. So if it was always in the plan, keep it. Because it seems like sticking to everything else that he's done has worked really well so far.
Yeah, I think he was always going to stick to it. It was just a matter of whether they were going to go into that break with a good result at Arsenal, which they were obviously so close to getting, or they would have to deal with the disappointment of being handed a loss that maybe, you know, how athletes will do, they'll kind of start to spin it in their mind as they've been hard done, or it was they were unfairly handed that dismissal, and a couple weeks to sit on that probably wasn't the best thing. Regardless, it's obviously in the past now. They're back in the win column. My list is similar to Lawrence's. I have Leicester 1, Spurs 2, although I do still debate that every week. I, based on what I saw this weekend, am not putting Arsenal above City. I have City 3rd and Arsenal winning the Wenger Trophy. Gentlemen, let's talk about the couple of games that we haven't mentioned so far from the Premier League. Let's start with the first match of the weekend. West Ham 1-0 victory over Sunderland. Michael Antonio scoring in the first half. The Hammers holding on throughout the next hour of the match. This is significant because West Ham is now only 4 points back of a Champions League spot. They're right on Manchester United's heels, United being in fifth place. But it's also significant because, at least on paper, this might have been a match, Lawrence, where Sunderland, playing decently lately, might be able to take a point from West Ham, and it just didn't happen. They're now down to 11 matches to get back above that relegation line.
Yeah, kind things don't seem to treat Sam Allardyce like that so much anymore. I think he used up a lot of that while he was at Bolton. It was down to West Ham again and the way that they didn't. What I basically want to say about this game is I don't feel that West Ham have been lucky this season, but I do feel like sometimes other teams have let them off. And in this match, you'd say that they'll feel a little bit let down that Jermaine Defoe didn't put away some of his chances. Yeah. Sam Allardyce was never going to come out and immediately sort of put it on him. But to me, it kind of boils down for that. You know, I've seen them play in a number of games where a lot of the players gone through very few players for West Ham, which is basically Dimitri Payet to the front guys. And really glad they've got Emenike in there because of the qualities that he brings to the side, not only pace and movement, but also the finishing that we've seen more recently. And then obviously, I think most West Ham fans this season would pick out Antonio as the other standout guy. So, you know, they've got some key players to go to in there, but I also think if you block their plan A, then there's very little sort of immediate and effective plan B for West Ham. Mm-hmm. And, I feel like Sunderland did that fairly effectively, but at the same time, didn't manage to get players going the other way.
Along with Defoe, the biggest culprit, in my opinion, was Rodwell, who should have had a hat trick in this game and missed a couple of clear-cut chances and one that was kind of difficult. Yeah.
Hmm.
You know, Sunderland, though, with this, gave away away shirts to every away fan in this game.
Wow, because, I didn't know.
Because just for making the trip?
Thanks for sticking around.
No.
You know?
Yeah, I guess that's
what I was saying. We know this must have been hard.
Nipun, I want to talk about Southampton-Chelsea in a minute, but one game we haven't at all mentioned was Watford and Bournemouth. 0-0 draw here. I guess any time Watford plays lately, it's apt to end in a 0-0 draw. What should we take about this match regarding... Watford's kind of stuck in mid-table at this point, but Bournemouth specifically, what should we take from about their chances to pull away from that relegation battle?
For Bournemouth, the only bright spot was Max Gradle. I thought he had a very good game, linked well with the Phoebe, should have had some great interchange in the box, actually, lots of 1-2s. Maybe his finishing let him down just a little bit.
Wow, Max Gradle's back. That's amazing.
Yeah. So
this 2 week break was awesome. Everybody's healthy now.
But the big talking point, Richard, has to be Gomez. I mean, Gerardo Gomez is someone I think is easy to poke fun at because of some of the mistakes he's made over the season. But if you haven't had a chance to watch it, watch his save from Arthur, which was, I think, a 30-yard strike. It's probably one of the saves of the season. You could watch that over and over again. Left-handed save, headed towards the top corner, saw it late. Just a terrific save. So those are two big things for me, one each for each team, mm-hmm. which is about right, for a 0-0 team, mm-hmm. for a 0-0 game. Yeah.
Gentlemen, let's conclude our discussion of the weekend's results by talking about Southampton and Chelsea. And I've saved this one for last because I think there's something on both sides of this pitch that we can talk about. Let's talk about Chelsea. And Lawrence, I want to talk to you about the Blues. There seems to have been a turnaround over these last three games, maybe one that was ignited by going up against City's third, fourth choice team in the FA Cup. As is, that led to a good performance against Paris Saint-Germain. And this is a result that I just didn't think they were going to get. I just didn't think they were as good a team as Southampton. Maybe they aren't, but they still got a 2-1 victory at St. Mary's against a team that just was not allowing goals.
Yeah, but then I also think if you look at the way that Chelsea have been playing over the last few matches, there have still been some truisms about the team. That, you know, Hazard hasn't done particularly well this season, that at times Diego Costa's been found wanting and frustrated himself. And still at the base of that midfield, they can find them to be very ineffective going forward. And they're still not, as a side, I still don't find them mobile enough. Mm-hmm. I think that was basically found out that sometimes they're a little bit sluggish. And that was where Shane Long sort of capitalized in this game because of it wasn't lazy. It was just unfortunate defending from Baba across to Ivanovic and in pop Shane Long with a lovely little finish. I think that'll definitely change come Conte. I think Conte wants this side to run at 200 kilometers an hour, is what he said with his previous Juve team.
Seems
and
fast.
I'm just looking at this side and thinking, who there is going to run 200 kilometers an hour? There's people I can definitely put in that won't run 200 kilometers an hour. Maybe Willian.
Yes.
Get back to me. Just come back to me, yeah?
Yeah, William kind of seems like a coach's dream at this point between his skills and his actual work ethic and his decision making.
But I mean, maybe that's also part of why he was included in the center there for them, was because mm-hmm. if you look at the back five / back three that Southampton have been playing, it's been particularly impressive. And, you know, at the center of that's been Font. You've got Van Dijk on one side of him and sorry, I forget who played on the other side of him. Was it what wasn't what Font that played on the other side? Was it Font? So you've got Font, Van Dijk, and who's on the other side?
They usually have Bertrand there, and then they have, when they play three at the back, they'll have Bertrand there, and they'll have Matty Target as the left.
Yeah, sorry, Matty Target was there as well, yes, sir. I was off target with his name.
Well done, that was good.
Obviously, Soares on the other side. Still, the back three, I think a lot of managers have kind of struggled to make that work, but the more that we're seeing tactics evolve forward, the easier it becomes to play a 4-4, not easier, but the kind of more sense it becomes to make either play a 4-4-2 or an almost 3-5-2. And the two up front, I think, are just as important as the three or four at the back.
Yeah, Southampton's back three are really interesting because I think when we think of a back three, we usually think of something that is akin to what Juventus has implemented over the last two or three years, speaking of Conte, where you have three central defenders, essentially. Southampton's is almost different because they have very skilled players on the right and left, and it's a little bit closer to what you might theoretically want a three-man back line to be, where Bertrand is really a fullback, so when you shift that back line over, he can actually play a little bit out in front as you go to the flank, and then Van Dijk actually has the skills to make the passes in a very similar vein. In that way, it adds a wrinkle to when you're thinking about the matchups. Usually when you think of a back three going against a lone striker, you think that you're devoting too many men to that striker and you end up losing numbers battles elsewhere. But it's really easy for that back three to shift into what functions as a back two when you're in possession. And I think that's what part of what makes it effective. At the same time, Nipun, it does put you in a situation where if you're not scoring enough goals, you have to ask whether you're devoting too many resources to your back three and the wingbacks. And if there is a criticism of Southampton, it is for all of their defensive prowess, they really haven't been scoring that many goals this year, only 35 through 27 games. And in that vein, one other goal in this game would have made a huge difference before Chelsea's comeback.
Yeah, I think they shifted out of that five formation. I mean, I think they went four at the back in this game with Van Dijk and Font and Bertrand and Suarez on the right. Mm-hmm. But I think the problem became, as you said, they don't have enough quality going forward. The long goal was pretty much a gift from Baba Rahman. So without that, they wouldn't have even had one shot. But I think let's just agree that tactically Southampton, towards the end of this season, well, the second half of the season, have set up to be defensively strong, and it's worked well for them. If you remember at the start of the season, they were really struggling with defensive situations, hemorrhaging goals. So what Koeman's been able to do is tidy up that defense, and it's pretty much propelled them up the table. So there's not been much reason for him to play with that. But I mean, I agree. They don't create nearly as much as they used to. Maybe that has to do with the fact that Sadio Mane hasn't been involved as much as he was towards the start of the season.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Mane now has been coming off the bench the last few games. Even like you said, when they go back to four at the back in this game, they still have Mane on the bench. Tadic didn't get any time whatsoever.
Right.
Graziano Pele seems to have lost his starting spot and has become a substitute over the last 3 or 4 months. At the same time, you're talking about the team that has the depth to have Charlie Austin, Shane Long, Davis in the starting lineup. And in central midfield, even with Wanyama suspended, they can start players like Oriel Romeo and Jordi Clasie and have Ward-Prowse to come off the bench. So a lot of options there. Maybe that's leading to the flexibility that we're talking about. Regardless, they need to find a way to start scoring some more goals. Gentlemen, we have a full slate of matches in the Premier League. 5 on Tuesday, 5 on Wednesday. I'm not really sure how to tackle this, but let's start with the biggest game of the week, at least in name, Lawrence, and that's on Wednesday, Liverpool versus Manchester City. A bit of an anticlimax here because we just saw this game today.
Or did we just see this game?
Or did we just see it?
Really won this game?
I don't know.
Was the moral winner really Man City in this one? obviously, it's gonna be interesting to see how it plays out, mainly because, being a 1-1 draw, I think really Liverpool obviously want the points here, and so do Man City in order to keep up with the pack. I think they'll probably end up fielding very similar sides. I'll be interested to see whether Klopp ends up experimenting a little bit with his front line or back line. And also how the shape of that Liverpool midfield can do. I think Klopp will learn from this. And I think, again, Liverpool are going to try and implement some of the things that they tried but didn't maybe work out in this match.
Nipun, I want to ask you about the matches for the teams that are in the title race beyond Manchester City. We'll take these as a group. And I'll ask you, where do you think points might be dropped or picked up? On Tuesday, Leicester is hosting West Bromwich Albion. And then on Wednesday, Tottenham has a derby at Upton Park against West Ham United. And Arsenal is hosting Swansea. Seems like Tottenham has the biggest challenge of those three.
Yeah, I think out of those three, Tottenham is probably the one most likely to drop points. But they've been so darn consistent that even a tricky game, London derby game might not be proved to be very difficult for them. You and I talked about how Harry Kane might be missing. He came back right away and was involved even today in the build-up to one of the goals, had a good game. So Yeah, I don't see an upset in any of those three games.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence, I want to ask you about the next level of the table. We talked about Liverpool a little bit, and then Nipun hinted on what's happening with West Ham. The other teams that are fighting for those Europa League spots, Manchester United hosts Watford on Wednesday, and then Southampton is going to be visiting Bournemouth on Tuesday. On paper, that looks like 3 points for each of those teams, but given the inconsistency of both of those sides, mm-hmm. paper probably doesn't matter that much.
Yeah, although I'm really interested to see how this Watford side is going to play against Manchester United. I mean, you know, obviously we're talking about the real positives, but the Manchester United and the youth that Manchester United played with has played against two sides. I mean, first of all, I think Michelin capitulated to some extent against Manchester United.
Sure, yeah. And then,
you could apply a sort of similar idea to Arsenal, although not exactly the same one. But, you know, and I feel like Watford are very different. Obviously, what's vital for Watford is the running of their front two. And I just wonder how well Manchester United is going to be able to shut down that as a combination. Because when you shut that down, I think it makes them much less effective as a side. If you don't allow them to hold up the ball, etc., then it really becomes a lot more difficult for them. United haven't really played well against a side like that so far in Shrewsbury, Michelin, etc. So let's see how they cope against that, especially considering how astute Flores tends to be with these sorts of games.
And then, Nipun, let's talk about the relegation battle, the four matches that really put that in focus. Starting on Tuesday, Aston Villa hosting an Everton team that saw their Merseyside derby postponed this weekend. Norwich is hosting an increasingly improving Chelsea team. Sunderland hosts Crystal Palace. And then on Wednesday, Stoke gets a visit from Newcastle United. Where do you think points might be swapped amongst those four fixtures?
So the I think it'll be Stoke Newcastle. I have a feeling that Newcastle's actually gonna have the beating of Stoke.
Power of Mini Ibra.
Yeah, I do. I do doubt the power of, what did you say, Dollar Store Ibra?
Yeah, Dollar Store Ibra,
which should be probably the name of this episode of the podcast because it's really good. Hashtag Dollar Store Ibra. This is a gut feeling that I think Newcastle might have the beating of Stoke City. I think Stoke have shown that they don't tend to do well when games are kind of pushed together, and in this case they're playing 3 or 4 days after their previous game, so just for that simple reason and the fact that Newcastle has had a break, I think Newcastle might have to beat Stoke.
Well, everybody, when those games are played, myself, Kartik Krishnayar, will be coming to you with a Premier League review midweek as well as a preview of the upcoming weekend's action. But until then, for everybody at the World Soccer Talk family of sites, I'm Richard Farley for Nipun Chopra. Lawrence,
enjoy your football.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is a production of World Soccer Talk and is executive produced by Christopher Harris and produced by Richard Farley. You can get the podcast a number of different ways, including Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Audioboom, or you can go to worldsoccertalk.com to download the show directly. To get in touch with one of the hosts, you can reach out to them on Twitter. I'm Richard Farley. Kartik is KKFLA737. Lawrence is LOZCAST, Lawscast. And Nipun is Nipun Chopra 7. Don't want to bother with Twitter? Go ahead and reach out via email. Richard@worldsoccertalk.com.